Thanks, as always, Jonathan. Hello and welcome to the Albert Hall for the penultimate night of this 2011 BBC Proms season. For many years, this last but one evening meant Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Tonight, we'll be hearing another German masterpiece that's almost exactly contemporary with the Ninth, Weber's opera, Der Freischütz, The Marksman, the archetypal early romantic opera with the battle of good against the evil at its heart. It was a huge success at its premiere in Berlin in 1821. It began a triumphant progress around Europe. Paris, too, was interested in it, and a bowdlerized version under the title Robin des Bois, kind of Robin Hood, I suppose, was performed there. The teenager Berlioz knew Weber's original had been hacked to pieces as Robin, but he was still so gripped by the music that he went to every performance. Berlioz was enthralled to Weber, not least to his orchestration. So when 17 years later the Paris Opéra decided it wanted a bite of the Freischütz cherry, Berlioz was the man they asked to provide both the sung recitatives, spoken text wasn't allowed at the opera, and the ballet, which was an essential in every opera performed there. The result, Le Freischütz, is what we hear tonight with a fine international team of soloists, the Monteverdi Choir and the Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique, conducted by John Elliott Gardner, a team which earlier this year gave a run of performances at the Opéra Comique in Paris. So how does he see this opera?
It's a real sort of bran tub. Bits of Baroque, bits of classical, bits of romantic. You never know quite what's going to come up next. There's elements of folklore. There's certainly a proto or even real romantic spirit in the way he conceives his characters, particularly the two lovers, Max and Agathe. There is lots of classicism in it, both in the forms of the actual structure of the way the music is put together. But there is this flavor that you find in Weber, which is disturbingly new in this period.
Outside and in the forests of Bohemia, the locals celebrate the victory of the wealthy peasant Kilian, sung by the baritone Samuel Evans, in a shooting contest. He taunts the defeated forester Max, who draws a knife on him. Kuno, the head forester, bass Matthew Brook, breaks things up. With him, the forester Gaspard, the bass Guidon Sachs, who takes Max, the tenor Andrew Kennedy, to one side and suggests he should sell his soul to the devil as he himself has done. Kuno reminds Max he needs to win the shooting competition the next day in Prince Ottokar's presence in order to gain both the hand of his daughter Agathe and take over his position as head forester. Kuno tells the story of his ancestor who was able to shoot a stag without injuring the thief who was tied to it. As a reward, the Prince of Bohemia made him head forester, and this is the hereditary title which will be passed on to his son-in-law. Kilian says he was told it was done with the aid of a magic bullet, the legend that six bullets will find the target, but the seventh will strike where the devil ordains. Kuno tries to cheer Max up by reminding him of the power of love and tells him that if he's brave, he'll win the contest, and so the hand of his beloved Agathe. On his own, Max broods over the loss of his skill, believing heaven has abandoned him. Gaspard reappears out of the gloom, encourages Max to have a drink, and starts singing drinking songs himself while quietly invoking the black huntsman, Zamiel. Max is repelled by the tasteless songs, is about to leave when Gaspard, goading him by suggesting that Max is off to tell Agathe of his imminent defeat, urges him to pick up his gun and shoot a hawk, scarcely visible in the night sky. Max fires, Zamiel laughs, and a golden eagle drops at Max's feet. He asks about the bullet which achieved such a perfect shot, and Gaspard explains it's a magic bullet. Max, desperate for victory in tomorrow's contest, asks for one, but Gaspard tells him it was his last. More can be cast, though, if they go to the Wolf's Glen at midnight. Max is terrified but agrees, and Gaspard is left alone to gloat over the new victim he will be able to present to the devil. Well, as you heard, the orchestra is already on stage. Peter Hansen, the leader, has tuned them, and the Monteverdi Choir, at this point all in black, are making their way behind the orchestra. It says in the programme this is a concert performance. I'd say it was more of a semi-staged. There are moments of concert performance, but quite a lot of activity, as you'll hear. Monteverdi Choir just processing into place below Sir Henry Wood. I wonder what he thinks of Freischütz in French. Well, actually, this hall, or the proms, the Queen's Hall as well, have never heard this opera at a prom. This is its proms debut, either in German or in French. And the Monteverdi Choir is now complete on the stage. Quite a big pit orchestra, as it were, in the Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique. For those of you who keep tallies, we've got 5 double basses. And now here come tonight's soloists, led by Guidon Sachs. And followed by John Elliott Gardner to perform Act 1 of Weber's opera Der Freischütz in the French version with recitatives by Weber's great admirer, Berlioz.
Thank you. cet usage-là, maître, contez-nous donc cela. Un braconnier puni d'avoir enfreint les lois. Le prince ému promet soudain la place de garde héréditaire à qui délivrera le malheureux. Mon aïeul calomnie, le cerf tombe, hurra, le braconnier vivra. Chacun loup obtint l'emploi promis et qui doit à mon chambre est après moi transmis.
Cette prouesse en tout lieu fut vantée.
Les envieux parlaient d'une balle enchantée abonnée de sa miel.
C'était l'esprit malin, un piège m'a-t-on dit. Ma grand-mère, souvent, m'en a parlé d'honneur. Si ce balle la porte, elle a ce qui aime, appartient au démon qui la dirige à son gré.
Oh, les jolies codes, à ce temps-là, remontent à tel usage. Or ça, à voir la maison si les batteurs sont prêts. Et quant au piège du diable, c'est l'amour qui fit le sortilège. Mais il réussira demain aux yeux de tous. Allons, courage, et sois exact au rendez-vous.
Sonic Cosmic!
soyons amis et veillons à la fortune. En attendant, viens danser.
Moi, danser.
Viens, sans toi, la balle va commencer. Avec moi, qui veut bien valser.
Salve, salve. Thank you. altesse. Tu ne bois pas de tel jus.
Pour la dernière fois,
va, foi de la tristesse, avec ce brio charmant. Les jours passent tous qu'est bon. Oh, belle fraise. Ma prière c'est des chers, et lorsque je fais un peu, c'est au pied de ma maîtresse. C'est au pied de ma maîtresse. Partir, tu vas donc à ta belle apprendre ta défaite.
Hélas, ma pauvre enfant,
quel pronostic de fête pour demain. Juste suis mon conseil, c'est un service sans pareil.
Un service, et lequel?
Secret de chasse pour voir ici le disque de la lune et ses soirs obscurcis. Quelques grains de choses on te garde sous l'ombre.
Puisse-t-il pour moi le poison goutte à goutte?
Attends, prends mon fusil. Ne passera-t-il rien? Ah, c'était perdu, qui était peur?
Moi, quel délire, il est hors de mon vie, et je ne vois pas là.
Fais, que dis-je?
Qu'as-tu donc arrivé? Ah, qu'est-ce là?
Juste sous l'âne, on pourrait l'empailler pour quelques muséums d'histoire naturelle.
Dis, cette balle, quelle est-elle?
Cette balle?
Oui, réponds sans me railler. Cette balle?
Portée de cuirasse, et qui les couvrait bien, et pourtant,
Chien.
Toi, pour toi, qu'il double soir gris, prendre une bonne place, épouser une fille charmante.
Parles-tu donc encore de ces balles-là?
Non, j'ai puisé mon trésor.
Mais je m'entends, quoi qu'il en coûte, peut-on s'en procurer?
Viens à minuit dans la gorge du loup.
C'est elle, qualité, sa mère.
Il manque de courage.
Adorable, cet outrage.
Eh bien donc, fais ce que je veux. Ce n'est que je l'envoie pour vendre ses deux mâles. Il n'y consent pas, la fortune va dans le temps. L'amour pour la femme, pour toi, la femme, la honte. Oh, Samuel, à moi.
Agathe, mourir, moi, me jeter dans la vive. Non, non, j'irai, mal à mon crime, j'irai.
Thank you. voir pour le coup.
Gaspar's triumph luring Max to the Wolf's Glen. Act one of Weber's opera, Der Freischütz, in the French version for the Paris Opera with recitatives by Berlioz. Here at the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3 in this BBC Proms performance, the Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique, conducted by John Elliott Gardiner. Well, in Act two, we finally get to meet Max's beloved Agatha, daughter of Kuno the head forester, son of the soprano Sophie Kartäuser. A portrait of Kuno's great-grandfather just fallen off the wall of her room, and Agatha with her relative Annette, soprano Virginie Pochon, nailing it back up again. On the eve of her wedding to Max, Agatha is uneasy. Annette tries to cheer her up, telling her of how she enjoys flirting. She asks Agatha about her visit to the old hermit. She replies that he blessed her and gave her some white roses, but warned her she was born under an unfortunate star that dangers await. Agatha says she'll wait up for Max. She prays for protection, and as she sees Max coming towards the house, her spirits soar. He has to admit he didn't win the shooting contest, but boasts of how he shot the eagle. He sees the blood on Agatha's forehead. She tells him about the falling picture. The inquisitive Annette has returned, discovers the picture fell at the very moment Max killed the bird. Max hides his concern at this coincidence by telling the girls he has to go and fetch a stag he's shot. The scene moves to the Wolf's Glen, where unearthly cries are heard. A church clock strikes midnight as Gaspar appears from the darkness and summons the black huntsman, Zamiel. Gaspar, having sold his soul to the devil, is due to forfeit his life unless he can find a new victim. He tells Zamiel he's done just that. Max appears, terrified. Gaspar persuades him to climb down to the place where they will cast the magic bullets, despite the the apparitions of his mother and Agatha trying to prevent him.
Thank you. autrefois, ranimé tout à coup sortait de ses parois. Que dis-tu sans être craintive? Je t'avouerai que j'aime mieux les vivants que les morts, les jeunes que les vieux.
Yannick, expliquez-vous.
tour de Max en ce lieu je demeure. À ton aise, bonsoir. Car dans son doux essor, son intéressant de son aile m'effleure. Hélas,
Mon bonheur était dans ta main, tu fus heureux. possible. Moi, c'est comme un bras impassible. Pardon, pardon, on est le trapard, l'on s'en va. Qu'as-tu donc? Tu sens?
Ce portrait m'a blessé. Quel accueil pour ta fiancée.
Comment ce portrait?
Il était mal suspendu.
Aussi, pourquoi lorsqu'il sonne 7 heures te mettre à ton balcon?
C'est elle, dis-tu?
Elle guette toujours quand au loin tu demeures.
C'est elle, cet oiseau, par moi fut abattu.
Tu parles seul, tu parais triste, te plaindrais-tu de moi?
Quand je parle de joyeux, à gage de succès, il enfonce tes yeux. Est-ce en cela qu'un tendre amour consiste?
Ne sont pas injustes, amis. Ces grands oiseaux sont d'un fatal présage.
Ils sont nobles et beaux.
Pourquoi rêver ainsi? Sais-tu comme je t'aime? Oh, Max, sens-toi le plus beau sang pour mon fidèle cœur. Ne voudrais pas la mort.
Je dois pourtant partir à l'instant même.
Et quoi?
Je peux une seconde fois.
Vraiment?
Le plus beau des exploits. Ma vieille de ses écoles. Les paysans au fond des bois, cette nuit, pour le bien se rendre. Je ne veux pas manquer le prix d'un si bon coup.
Où t'en as-tu laissé?
Dans la gorge de
l'eau. Dans la gorge de l'eau.
Et qu'il entend fuit de terre.
qui sait, quelle est-elle? Bientôt sont écoulés.
Thomas!
Des classes pour prolonger l'île.
Non!
Je puis payer tout est bien fait.
Thomas!
La chaîne marche ce soir. Oh, ta puissance a placé son espoir.
Pourquoi?
C'est pour avoir des pas les enchantés.
Six pour lui, mais seul, la septième à moi.
La messe est acceptée, la septième est tira. Si on a gardé si chère, que savoir et désespère, Max les empêche.
Elle ne m'appartient pas. Encore!
Les pauvres vêtus d'en bien!
Nous verrons!
De toi j'attends un délai de 3 ans, j'aurai pour toi d'offres présents!
Soit! Par les portes de l'enfer! Donne-moi! Max, ou toi?
Ce Max, elle est drôle, manquerait-il à sa parole? La modèle est sa mienne.
Thank you. tu me ravances?
Non, je n'ose pas.
Poltre,
sois-tu là?
Chasseur noir, que tout redoute, Samiel, ô Samiel, écoute. Toi qui es par ton pouvoir, des chasseurs l'ultime espoir. j'apprête, par trois, par neuf et par sept. Tu prendras ta balle à la fin, et que l'ultime coup soit tien. Samuel. Oh, puissant Samuel.
Strikes one, Samuel the Black Huntsman vanishes, but the magic bullets are struck
Gaspar has won himself a reprieve with his proposal to deliver another human soul to the devil. The end of Act Two of Weber's opera Der Freischütz, the epitome of German romantic opera, sung tonight in French in the version made by Berlioz for Paris with his own recitative instead of the spoken dialogue. In this concert performance on the penultimate night of the 2011 BBC Prom season, live on Radio 3, Max is sung by Andrew Kennedy, Gaspar by Guy Dansacks. Agatha Sophie Cartoza and Annette Virginie Pochon, Killian, sung by Samuel Evans, Kuno by Matthew Brook, the spoken role of Zamiel, taken by Christian Pellissier, with the Monteverdi Choir and the Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique, conducted by John Elliott Gardner. That was wonderful stuff, with the girls up in the balcony, and the owl hoots and the screams down in the arena, the promenaders wondering exactly what was going on. Gaspar with an empty tympanum, actually, which was steaming just below Sir Henry's bust, and that was where the bullets were cast. Well, extraordinary how the change of language makes it such a different piece, more sensuous, related to Gounod's Faust looking forward and the French Revolutionary rescue operas looking back. And those recitatives seem quite seamless, difficult to tell where Weber becomes Berlioz. Well, after that long first part of the evening, everyone's glad to regroup and refresh in the interval before the denouement of the shooting contest in Act 3 of Le Freischütz. But for the next 20 minutes here on Radio 3, we can hear from tonight's conductor, John Elliott Gardner, discussing this version of the opera earlier today down at the Royal College of Music with Tom Service.
John Elliott, where does this association between the two composers start?
Berlioz was much younger than Weber, but when Weber was coming through Paris on his way here to London to conduct and to do the premiere of Oberon, his last opera, and where he met his death, alas, from TB, the London smogs got to him.
This is 1826.
He came through Paris, and Berlioz made a huge effort to meet him, because he revered this man so much, and it didn't come to anything, alas. Because I think not only would have they had a lot of sympathy and empathy for one another in terms of their musical objectives, but also Berlioz and, at this stage, Weber were outraged by the way that, not just once, but two or three times, that Castil Blas had purloined, really, there's no other word for it, Weber's music.
Castil Blas was the guy who did this mutilation of Robin des Bois.
And there. He did it, he thought he was doing Weber a good turn. He thought he was fixing the opera for him.
He did the same to Mozart, didn't he?
He did the same to Mozart, and... The French have this strange copyright law, which means that if a piece is composed in Germany or Russia or Britain or Italy, if it's done in France, the arranger gets the copyright and pockets it.
It's a sweet deal, really.
It gets the royalties. I mean, it makes sort of downloading off the internet seem quite tame in comparison. And eventually, Weber got wind of this and wrote an extremely courteous but very firm letter to Castil Blas. And Castil Blas was quite surprised. He said, but you know, I'm only trying to help you.
So the point is, the opera wasn't known fully to French audiences until Berlioz was asked to put together the complete version of Der Freischütz in 1840, 1841.
That's correct. I mean, the thing was that Berlioz had a score, a vocal score, admittedly, and he compared what he had in his hand and the sounds that he heard emerging from the orchestra of Castil Blas and was horrified. And then he heard it again in Berlin, I think in about 1827. And then the Opéra, who were always about 20 years behind other theatres in Paris, they decided they were going to do homage to Weber in 1840 and to put on what they called Le Freischütz. And they asked Berlioz to supervise the production, and Berlioz was thrilled to do so, hoping that he would actually get to conduct it. And unfortunately, they didn't ask him to conduct it. What they asked him to do was to write recitatives, because Weber's opera is a Singspiel. It's got melodrama, it's got arias, it's got choruses, it's got wonderful orchestral interludes, but it's got spoken text.
Like the Magic Flute in its original.
Like the Magic Flute, like in Führung. And that was not allowed at the Opéra, So Berlioz very, very reluctantly, against his better judgment, said, all right, I will write recitatives, but I don't want to do it, hoping that he would get to conduct it, and of course he didn't. But he did get to supervise the cast, and he did make sure that there were no cuts, and the original orchestration was observed.
So really,
and he was scrupulous
about
really this.
Precisely, Weber. I mean, he was. There isn't a single note in this version we're going to hear tonight where Berlioz was tempted to go, what, do you know what, Weber, we could do with a couple more trombones or something.
Correct.
It's all exactly the same.
Correct. The only Berlioz that you'll hear tonight are the recitatives, plus his wonderful orchestration of the Invitation à la Valse of Weber, which is a purely an orchestral showcase, and it's absolutely brilliant.
Invitation to the dance, just in case anybody needed that translation. So what about the recitatives then, John? I mean, is this Berlioz trying to do an impression of Weber? Is he consciously giving himself to the drama?
Yes, he's giving himself to the drama. I mean, it's not pastiche. He is very sober in his approach to the recitatives. He uses just strings, or occasionally two flutes and two clarinets together and a horn. But what he does with a restricted palate is just glorious. And it's just instantly recognizable that it is Berlioz and not Weber. And though Berlioz is trying to efface his personality and to take himself out of it, he's got such a strong musical imprint that it comes through. And he, one shouldn't, I don't think, take him literally at his word when he said he was dissatisfied with them. In his memoirs, he said, oh, I thought they were terrible, I was dissatisfied with them. But actually, he ought to have been jolly proud of them, because the problem that Berlioz had was with the singers, as so often, that the singers sang the recitatives as though they were opera, and they dragged them, and they underlined too many words, and it didn't flow. And that's something I've tried desperately to correct with this very, very good cast that we've got, because before we sang a note of this in Paris, when we were doing this in March and April, we read the whole thing, we read the text, and did it at speed. And I timed each of the bits of Singspiel, the spoken dialogue, and then we sang it and tried to make sure that we were within 10 seconds of the duration, because I think that's the pace that's required. So it should topple along quite well, I hope.
So on stage, that worked then? The rest of the team's worked in the production?
Yeah, it's a through composed work.
Look, in a way, this comes to the nub of it. If we think of Der Frösch, it's in the sweep of music history, the probably laziest cliché that I was almost certainly guilty of when I in the Proms podcast that some of you may have the opportunity to have heard, is that it's a very important work of German opera and is in some way a predecessor or something that inspired Berlioz, Wagner particularly, and sort of cemented ideas of the supernatural, a certain kind of what would become a sort of obsession with later 19th century German opera. But John Elliott, I think what you'd like to tell me and probably the world is that that's completely wrong, and that in fact Der Freischütz has at least one leg, if not two, in French opera.
It's not completely wrong, because it did have a huge influence on German opera, and that was certainly Weber's intention. He was trying to invent a school of German opera.
Right.
The problem is he had no models other than the failure of Fidelio, as it was in his day, and of course Magic Flute and Entführung. But his aim was to create a new school of German opera, he and Louis Spohr. But interestingly, his models for it were nearly all French. And in the years when Weber was running the Dresden Opera, of the 12 operas that he revived, I think 10 of them were actually French operas. If you count Cherubini as a French composer, which I suppose you should do, because he lived in France most of his time. And you may say, well, what's the point? Is that important? It's only important in the sense that the French revolutionary composers, Méhul particularly, Grétry, Dallairac, and Cherubini, were building on Baroque opera, the Baroque opera of Rameau, and to some extent of Lully and Charpentier in the previous century, in the way that they were combining all sorts of different elements. They were combining dance, they were combining melody, orchestral, evocative music to link scenes, divertissement, wonderful choruses, and what the French prized above all, which is le merveilleux, the magical. which is stage effects, machinerie, and that's what Weber was particularly keen to do, and he provided wonderful opportunities for it in Le Freischütz. But it's interesting that his opera, leave out the French story of what happened in Paris with Berlioz, but in Germany, it became subsumed in this gargantuan machine that was Richard Wagner, and that any music that preceded Wagner had to be somehow been pre-composed by Wagner in some bizarre kind of way. And the sad, I mean, that's fine. It's great to have a strong personality, but what's really sad is that if you go to a German opera house today, you will still see mostly, Freischütz is done, it's done as a proto-Wagnerian piece.
Yeah, but
You're going to have big breastplated Valkyries and
Huntsmen
in Lederhosen and, lots of and all that sort of stuff, which is, it's questionable whether that really has anything to do with the piece at all.
Right, thank you very much. Very good. Do you want to just perform that? But surely, there was a folk-like element to what Weber is doing. I mean, he does borrow from German folk tunes.
Oh, undoubtedly.
There is German folk storytelling in there.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's absolutely there. You can't, for all your francophilia, you can't deny that.
Not at all. And I'm not trying to. What I'm objecting to is the way of performing the opera as though it is a proto-Wagnerian
week. What you've referred to on videos, I know he's used these words, the Lederhosen and Valkyrie approach to their Freischütz. You've also called it a very dry singspiel in its original version, which suggests that you regard it suggests that what you think of this Berlioz version of Freischütz isn't simply that it's that we hear a Berliozan gloss on the piece, but rather you think, I wonder if you think, that this is really what the piece ought to have been all along.
No,
this
I don't version. Think that. I think that it stands up beautifully as a Singspiel, but Singspiels are a big compromise, aren't they? I mean, because of the two-paced nature of it. And I think that Berlioz deliberately or by chance, by serendipity, actually did Weber something of a favour through composing it. And it's for you to judge tonight, to see what you think. I mean, if it works as a continuous music drama. It certainly works on the stage that way. And I think it's good in European music, the culture that we prize so much, to see that there are different channels of influence that can throw a different perspective on, you know, iconic pieces.
So does this become a French opera? I mean, does even something like hearing the translation in French, does it become a French opera effectively tonight?
In a sense, I think the fact that we sing it in French gives it a totally different flavour. I mean, there's a difference between Der Jagd, the hunt, and La Chasse is already quite big. There's something about the French language and the sensuality of the French language which does colour it. But, you know, I think we should stop maybe making too much of a thing about whether it's French or German. The fact is that it's the collision of two wonderful composers here, who are just Promethean in their ambitions for music. I mean, if you had to choose a single decade of the 19th century, I reckon the 1820s would probably be it, when so much is going on. There's turmoil. I mean, the last years of Beethoven, the last years of Schubert, the beginnings of Berlioz, the end of Weber, the beginnings of Mendelssohn. So much is going on, and the essence of it really is the taking of literary models and literary culture and saying, by musicians, and saying, we can do this as well. We can encapsulate in music the poetry of Byron or of Goethe, of Schiller. We can make dramas, a drama of equivalent power. And this goes for Rossini, of course. I mean, it goes for anybody who collided with Schiller. It's an incredibly intoxicating time. And people had passionate views about the way music was going and what new language was erupting and available to musicians. The centre of it all is the use of the orchestra, because the orchestra, instead of being, even in the hands of a genius like Mozart, being a wonderful part of the whole web of characterization of the dramatis personae, it still is an orchestra that's accompanying. By the time you get to even Beethoven in the Fidelio, and by the time you get to Le Freischütz, and of course, when you get to Benvenuto Cellini in Le Trojans, Les Troyens, you've got the orchestra being really the motor, the engine room of the drama, and that's what's so exciting.
And that's really what Berlioz heard in Weber for the first time.
Because I think that's what he heard.
Gluck and Spontini don't do that, to be fair to them, do they?
So absolutely, I mean,
this is the sort of the psychology of the orchestra is expanding, the sense of everything being up for grabs, the sense of making those new sounds. And of course, what you're doing tonight with the Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique is, well, as you do so often in your performances, or all the time with the performances with that orchestra, you know, reclaim the sense of that newness, how it would have sounded, the excitement of the combinations of instruments that Berlioz and Weber are creating. So, I mean, how does your version of Le Fréchutz sound different to the sort of Germanic ones we may have heard on disc?
Well, the use of period instruments is always a tricky thing because it's a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. And when it becomes an end in itself, the chances are that it's not going to work. If it's a means towards approaching a little bit closer to the sound world that, as envisaged by two such interesting and original composers as Weber and Berlioz, then it's worth it, I think, because it... especially in the perspective of what I've just been referring to, of the orchestra moving it towards into the foreground, it creates a whole new range of dynamics and of colours, orchestral colours, instrumental colours, which contribute enormously to the experience of the listener. And the absolute classic case of this in this opera is the scene of the Wolf's Glen
at the end of Act Two.
Which is just a prodigious piece of music drama. I mean, the orchestras play non-stop for about 10 minutes, 12 minutes, and it's a monologue, or, well, it becomes a duo some of the time, between Gaspar, who's the baddie, and Max, who's the wronged hero. And it takes place in the forest, and there is this crucible where the bullets, the magic bullets, are being cast and forged. And you feel, I mean, picking up on your remark earlier, Tom, about the German folklore, it's absolutely German folklore, this. It's all to do with the concept of the forest and how important the forest is in German, the German psychology from 16th century onwards. I mean, I don't know whether any of you know that wonderful book that Simon Sharma wrote called Landscape and Memory, where he explores the psychological and metaphysical and iconic importance of the forest in the German psychology, both as a place of refuge and also as a place to find your roots, your Ur-Ur-Wald and your Ur-Ur-Roots, as it were. And of course, in the 30 Years' War, it was a place to rush off and hide from the from marauding armies, but also and a place to forage, to find food where you wouldn't find it in the open landscape. And it's just such a hugely important place. It's where good and evil coexist. It's where it's very spooky, but it's also full of energy. And this Wolf's Glen scene is a real exploration of the preoccupations of German thinkers and religious leaders from Martin Luther forwards.
But it's also, in this case, an absolute virtuoso case of what you could do with an orchestra. And also, again, thinking Weber wrote that in 1821, you know, Beethoven still had 6 years to live. I mean, nobody else was using the orchestra like that at that time, were they? I mean, this is absolutely the first time that the orchestra had been used this extremely, ever.
And pieces like The Damnation of Faust of Berlioz would have been inconceivable without it. The Ride to the Abyss is inconceivable. It's interesting that Berlioz started to write his eight scenes from Faust, from Goethe's Faust, pretty well after he'd first heard Freischütz for the first time.
What then do you think, is it possible to sum up what Weber's influence on Berlioz was, you know, after his death, when Berlioz is writing all the operas and the symphonies and quasi-symphonies that he would go on to do. Do you think you hear the Weber's influence right the way through the rest of Berlioz's life?
I think really what it amounts to is that both of them started off as talented, genial amateurs, because Berlioz was largely self-taught, was never intended by his parents to be a musician, had to fight his way through to become a musician. as he was meant to go and become a doctor, and then fought his way to get lessons from Le Sueur. And Weber himself was not the most talented, was not the most richly endowed a musician, if you compare him, say, to Mendelssohn, who was just prodigiously gifted from the word go. And yet both of them, through the power of their imagination, I think it's mostly imaginative force and power, found common ground between them and saw the orchestra as the way to be the pigment on their canvas. I think that's the key to it. And maybe there's something else too. There's the melodic gift. There's something so touching about Weber's use of an individual instrument. Often it's in this opera, it's often the clarinet, that and often very in a low tessitura, which is very spooky, that he, but when the clarinet is being lyrical, as in, for instance, Max's first act aria, he proposes a melody that doesn't always sit comfortably with the voice and with the words, but again, he's suggesting that the instrument can be just as poetic as the singer, and I think that's something that Berlioz picked up on.
So, Le Frère Schütz, a homage, but also a revelation. Johnny Elliott Gardner, thank you very much.
Tom Service talking to John Elliott Gardner earlier this evening down at the Royal College of Music. The producer was Helen Garrison. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall on this penultimate night of the 2011 season, live on Radio 3. I'm Martin Handley. We've reached Act 3 in the first ever Proms performance of Weber's opera Der Freischütz, conducted by John Elliott Gardner. When the Paris Opera decided to present this piece for the first time at their opera house, there were two main problems. The piece had absolutely no ballet, unheard of in any work presented there, as was any piece which included spoken dialogue. Berlioz had heard of what the opera proposed and wrote, "There is talk these days of pulling Der Freischütz to pieces, of seasoning it according to Parisian recipes. Fortunately, these rumours seem to have stopped." Well, he was wrong, and when he was asked to provide recitatives and ballet, replied that though he thought it a bad idea to get what he regarded as Weber's work performed and avoid somebody less devoted to his cause being asked to do it, he would accept. As far as the ballet was concerned, Berlioz's brainwave was simply to orchestrate Weber's own piano piece, Invitation to the Dance. Berlioz wrote to his sister Adele, "I am Weber's shield, and when I stage the rehearsals, I hope to put a bit of pep into these sluggardly rascals of singers." Well, earlier I talked to two of tonight's rascals, Guidon Sachs and Andrew Kennedy, and asked whether Freischütz needed singing in a different way in French.
It's much harder to sing in French, I have to say. And of course, when you sing the original language, it just all fits in your mouth like a peach melba. It's marvellous. I find French hugely challenging, and I was a bit overawed by it in the beginning and shed a few tears, but I got there eventually.
Andrew, do you think this piece has a relationship with French opera? I mean, just listening to a bit of it now, suddenly you do hear Faust or whatever.
Yeah, and certainly the French language changes it enormously. And I know that John Elliott wanted to cast it in a very specific way. He wanted to get away from the larger Heldon roles, which
well,
is
exactly.
why...
Max is often a Heldon tenor.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, it's incredibly low. It's a very mid-range part. Yeah. It's a challenge.
Guidon, you've done it in a German original, so with the spoken dialogue.
Yeah.
How for you do the recitatives work? Do they work? Does it help? Does it make it more fluid?
I have to say, I find them kind of refreshing and new and different. I think Berlioz almost sort of cherry-picked the most interesting stuff. And I'm fascinated by what he's done with it. And in the beginning, I felt that it didn't naturally always flow very organically from recit into aria or ensemble. But now it feels like it's the most normal thing in the world, and it's terrific to do. It's lots of fun.
Guidon Sachs and Andrew Kennedy. Well, Act 3 of Der Freischütz begins with Agathe in her room, putting her trust in God as she gets ready for her big day. Annetta appears and asks her whether she slept well. "No," she replies, "I had a nightmare. I was changed into a white dove and was shot. As I fell, I became myself again, with a black eagle at my feet covered with blood." Annette tries to interpret the dream in a positive way, but Agathe won't buy it, so Annette, as always, tries to cheer her up by telling her the tale of her great aunt, who's terrified by the clanking chains and fiery eyes she sees coming towards her. But when she wakes, it's just Nero, the watchdog. Bridesmaids come in to sing a folk song, bringing with them the box holding the bridal crown, and when Annette opens it, she finds instead a funeral wreath. Hastily, she weaves a new crown from the white roses Agathe was given by the hermit. As the huntsmen wait for the shooting competition to begin, they sing of the pleasures of the hunt before we hear that Parisian ballet interpolation, Berlioz's orchestration of Weber's Invitation to the Dance. Prince Ottokar, sung by the baritone Robert Davis, reminds the huntsmen why they're gathered. He tells Kuno Max will be a worthy son-in-law and wonders why the bride is late. Nerves, suggests Kuno, and the prince agrees to start the competition without her. The prince tells Max to shoot a white dove in a tree. Agata appears from behind the tree to tell Max she is the dove, but he fires and Agata falls to the ground, as does Gaspard. Agata slowly revives, and Gaspard realizes what's happened. Agata's protected by the white roses from the hermit. He curses the hermit and Zamiel himself as he comes to claim him. Max has to confess to Prince Ottokar that he made a pact with the devil, and the prince banishes him forever. Agata, Max, and Kuno are horror-struck, but the prince won't listen. He's interrupted by an old man, the hermit, sung by the bass Luc Bertin Hugo, who tells the prince his punishment is unjust for a man whose heart has remained true and who is full of remorse. Ottokar commutes the banishment to 1 year, after which Max and his Agata may marry. The hermit leads a song of thanksgiving for divine mercy. Well, orchestra assembled on the stage, as is the Monteverdi Choir, in wedding costume, well, bright 1930s French rural dresses for the ladies. The piece was set at the Opéra Comique in France, in rural France in the 1930s. Here comes John Elliott Gardner joining the Orchestre Révolutionnaire Romantique on stage here in the Albertori. Brings them to their feet. Before beginning Act 3 of Weber's opera Der Freischütz in Berlioz's French version.
Thank you. amitié si bonne. Il faut ouvrir ce coffre, l'on mit ta couronne, car voici tes filles d'honneur. Bonjour, belles enfants, pour lui portez bonheur, ce n'est plus la beauté que l'amour environne.
Acceptez ces bouquets, et chacune vous donne.
le genre me plaît.
Votre Altesse est trop bonne.
Autant que la petite.
Sommier, au bois.
Qu'un triomphe complet justifie en ce jour son choix. Et mon bienfait, prince, croyez qu'il le mérite.
Dieu, si mon bras tremblait,
je ne vois pas la fiancée.
Daignez permettre, monseigneur, que sans elle l'épreuve ici soit commencée. L'émotion redouble au moment du bonheur.
Volontiers, sans doute à Paris jour, le cœur battait aussi.
À la fête, voici, instant que je redoute. Oh, toi qui dans ma main n'aide plus la fatale, plongeante, ne me sois pas fatale.
Jeune chasseur, sois prêt. Tiens, cet oiseau qui tombe,
c'est la colonne blanche. Ah, soutiens-moi, mon Dieu.
Nous avons peur des sœurs et filles.
Thank you. Max's punishment is to be banished for just 1 year, after which he may return home to marry his Agatha. Well, that's the end of this Proms premiere of Weber's opera Der Freischütz in the version Berlioz made for the work's first performance in Paris in 1841. Well, the three bridesmaids were Lucy Roberts, Katie Hill, Kate Simons-Joy from the Monteverdi Choir. The hermit was Luc Bertin Hugo, Prince Ottokar, Robert Davis, Zamio, Christian Pellissier, Kuno, Matthew Brook, Killian Samuel Evans, Annette, Virginie Pochon, Gaspard, the baddie if you like, Guidon Sachs, Agatha Sophie Cartoza, and Max Andrew Kennedy. With the Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique, leader Peter Hansen, conductor John Elliott Gardner. Here comes Luc Bertin Hugo, the hermit. And if we hadn't seen him before, Zamiel himself, Christian Pellissier. Well, John Eric Garner said Weber and Berlioz both masters of dramatic pacing, and the French translation by Emilien Pacini, which Berlioz must have supervised, it worked really well. The language giving Freischütz that new sensuality and elegance. Somehow, this is sort of music which seems, you know, very similar to Beethoven's Fidelio, and appropriate on the penultimate night of the BBC Proms when Beethoven 9 is so often being performed. Virginie Poisson, Annette coming onto the stage. Might be some boos. No, thunderous cheers. Gaspar. Oh, what a few boos. Guido Sax, he's just folding his arms and giving it back to them. Larger than life figure. Well, John Elliott Gardner goes off to conduct Beethoven with the LSO and the Monteverdi Choir. We're doing Beethoven 9 at Beethoven Halle in Bonn, and then Bach motets, a motet tour with the Monteverdi Choir ending at St. John's Smith Square. That was for Sophie Cartoys of the Agathe, and here comes Andrew Kennedy, our anti-hero, if you like, Max. And John Elliott Gardner. Slightly sedate way, it's been a long evening for him, above all. Great energy throughout. Seems incredible we've got there already. Tomorrow at 7:30 here in the Albert Hall. And of course, live on Radio 3, the last night of the BBC Proms 2011 beckons. BBC Symphony Orchestra and chorus, of course, as always, conducted this year by Edward Gardner. Lang Lang playing Liszt and Chopin. Susan Bullock singing Wagner and Richard Rodgers. And it'll be the usual let your hair down end of season party. But as the Monteverdi Choir take their particular bow, with a great yell from everyone here in the Albert Hall, time for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain, back at Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, thank you. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, tomorrow night, as Martin was saying, the last night of the Proms, and the celebrations open with a new piece by the master of the Queen's music, Sir Peter Maxwell Davis, well, between now and the essay at 10:45. A Maxwell Davis piece from almost a couple of decades ago. Cross Lane Fair is one of his childhood memory pieces, the very young Maxwell Davis, personified by lilting Northumbrian pipes and a pattering bodhran, the Irish drum. And he's carried on his father's back through the Salford Fair, enjoying the lights and the music of the roundabout, slightly but pleasurably scared by the ghost train, dismayed at the freak show with its five-legged sheep, probably determining to imitate the juggler when he gets home, but falls asleep on his father's shoulder before he gets there. I'm afraid we don't have time for the entire piece, so let's join it at The Bearded Lady and The Five-Legged Sheep. The composer himself conducts the BBC Philharmonic. the close of Cross Lane Fair by Sir Peter Maxwell Davis, the composer himself there conducting the BBC Philharmonic. And his latest piece, Musica Benevolens, has its world premiere in tomorrow night's Last Night of the Proms. It's the opening piece, in fact. 7:30 for that, live from the Royal Albert Hall. And here on BBC Radio 3, and following on from the Max piece, there's Bartok's Miraculous Mandarin, the immolation scene from Wagner's Götterdämmerung with Susan Bullock as Brunhilde, and Lang Lang playing Liszt's first piano concerto. And that's only the first half of the concert. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 11:15. And now in the final programme in his series of essays about cinema of the 1940s, the writer and journalist Simon Heffer offers a fresh and personal interpretation of The Blue Lamp.
At the start of this long road through the British cinema of the 1940s, I sought to explain how films were used during the darkest hours of the Second World War to help bond society together. We were all in the same boat, with a common enemy, and war became a means of cohesion. By the end of the 1940s, reality had changed. In the voiceover that begins The Blue Lamp, filmed by Ealing Studios in the summer of 1949 and released in January 1950, an account is given of dislocation, decay, and destruction. Newspaper headlines, real rather than manufactured, are splattered across the screen. They detail armed robberies, shootings, and other crimes by predominantly young thugs who, we are told, lack the code of the professional criminal. We are further told that these are the products of households sundered by the very war that, a few years earlier, we thought was binding us together. Things have not turned out quite as we imagined.
To this man, until today, the crime wave was nothing but a newspaper headline. What stands between the ordinary public and this outbreak of crime? What protection has the man in the street against this armed threat to his life and property?
Realism is the hallmark of The Blue Lamp, even if today the film shows a society and a method of policing that seem to be from another planet. The impression at the time, though, was that the film showed such a troubling aspect of society that it sent a shockwave through Britain. For this is the film now best remembered as the one in which P.C. George Dixon, played by Jack Warner, is shot outside a cinema in the Edgware Road by a young robber played by Dirk Bogarde. This was 2 years before the infamous murder of a policeman by Christopher Craig and, by the law of common purpose, the unfortunate Derek Bentley. There was no question but that the ordered society was breaking down and that a delinquency problem was taking a grip on Britain. Ealing was just a little ahead of the game in bringing home this depressing fact to the public. The film sets out its stall unequivocally in that opening voiceover. Youths who engaged in crime had normally stuck to petty larceny. Serious crime had been the province of an established underworld, all of whom knew the rules. Early in the film, when Tom Riley, played by Bogarde, takes his sidekick Spud to solicit the cooperation of an old-school gangster in fencing the proceeds of a jewel robbery they're about to commit, the gangster tells them to get lost. Plainly, they don't know the rules, as he instinctively understands, and we shall soon see. Where it might be thought this film truly defies belief is in the denouement, where the underworld helps the police to catch Riley. But that is precisely what both criminals and the police of that era have testified would happen, not least to allow the former to carry on operating with the minimum of interference from the latter. Yet there is a further and more disturbing message in this film. Doubtless youths like Riley and Spud, of whose family backgrounds we are shown nothing, went wrong because of the absence of a firm parental hand. We see the context of domestic violence in which Riley's girlfriend lives with her feckless parents, its unpleasantness sufficing to make even him attractive to her. However, what we also see is the lid being blasted off a society whose heavy-handed centralisation and state control have not been alleviated by the advent of peace in 1945, but had, if anything, become even more apparent. The hand of the state was visible in almost everything in 1949, including how much of certain foods one could eat, how much clothing one could buy, and what young men could do with their lives. Riley and Spud must be on the verge of being called up for national service. I'm not saying that Riley shoots P.C. Dixon because he wishes to make a protest against the intrusion of the state into the lives of individuals. He shoots him because he is an immature, vicious thug. However, the society that produced Riley is one in which the roles of individuals, such as that of nurturing, have been marginalised, and the state has taken upon itself the notion that it, at all times, knows best. The Blue Lamp needs to be seen with two of the great Ealing comedies that came just before it, Whiskey Galore and Passport to Pimlico. What links these apparently disparate films, other than their having come from the same studios within a few months of each other, is what they say about contemporary society, its overregulation, and the officiousness of government. A particularly sharp comparison can be made between Passport to Pimlico and The Blue Lamp. They are both set in a London of summer heat, bomb sites, spivs, and restlessness. They were both written by T.E.B. Clarke. They both throw up significant challenges to authority, challenges that are successfully seen off, but, one suspects, only temporarily in the case of The Blue Lamp. The main difference is that Passport to Pimlico, like Whiskey Galore, makes its points with humour, while The Blue Lamp is almost like a documentary. Clarke's script for The Blue Lamp retains the respectable working-class values of Passport to Pimlico, here embodied by the police and their families. There is none of the cynicism about the force that would come later in dramatisations of their work after Operation Countryman in the 1970s, which exposed extensive and chronic corruption from the top to the bottom of Scotland Yard. However, in other respects, the approach could not be more different. There is an earnestness to the film that simply highlights the struggle that authority was having with a new world created by the end of the war and the explosion of welfareism. Even a cuddly beat policeman like George Dixon, who seems to know everyone on his manor and to know, too, how to deal with them without becoming heavy-handed, would have to change his way of doing business, were he to live long enough to do so. Dixon's main focus in life outside the job is his begonias, and sharing with his sweet and mumsy wife memories of their son, who appears to have died in the war. We are never told this explicitly, but he serves as an unseen contrast with the ghastly Riley in matters of service, duty and sacrifice. The Dixons acquire a substitute son in the form of Dixon's colleague Andy Mitchell, straight out of training college, whom they take in as a lodger. Dixon dies halfway through the film, but Clarke imposes him on his script in the first 40 minutes or so in a way that succeeds in making him the dominant presence even after he has died. In doing so, we get the clearest exposition of those working-class values of decency, solidarity, honesty and community that stand at the polar opposite to Tom Riley and his sort. When a panicking, hysterical Riley pulls the trigger and shoots Dixon twice in the abdomen, the look of shock on Dixon's face is not just at the physical pain, but at the fact that the natural order of things has been so inverted that this could happen. This was the moment that shocked Britain too, despite the upsurge in violent crime that had occurred in the late 1940s. As the voiceover at the start of the film said, serious professional criminals had a code. Here was its most brutal violation. Dixon has been called to the scene of a robbery at a cinema box office. Looking like something out of the cheapest American B-movie, Riley has covered the bottom of his face with a handkerchief tied round his head and brandishes a Wild West pistol at the cashier. His accomplice, the apparently even more bovine Spud, bludgeons the doorman, though Spud, who has warned Riley not to take a gun with him, instantly realises the gravity of what happens when Dixon is shot in a way that Riley, for a moment, affects not to. In the film's most famous exchange, Dixon tells Riley, "Drop it, son, don't be a fool." Words echoed unconsciously at the end of the film when the police corner Riley at the White City dog track. Riley tells Dixon to back off or "I'll drop you." Dixon doesn't imagine he's serious. Riley probably doesn't imagine he is either, but he pulls the trigger anyway. In this confrontation between anarchy and authority, there can be no winners. Justice comes at a price. Dixon dies later in hospital. Riley, we suspect, will end with a rope around his neck. It is ironic that Riley's capture is facilitated by the cooperation of the underworld. He tries to melt into the crowd at the White City dog track, but, alerted by the police, the management lock the doors so no one can get out. As criminals in the stands spot him darting about, they tell bookies, who use tic-tac to pass the message on. The police soon know where to find him. The combination of the forces of law and order with the forces of crime accentuates what Ealing must have hoped would be the message of the film, that people like Riley were beyond the pale and would be treated as such. The implication is that the overstepping of traditional boundaries would be a temporary phenomenon, and society, in all its other forms, would come together to ensure this was so. Unfortunately, what the film depicts is the beginning of a slippery slope. If the post-war settlement of the New Jerusalem is to be seen as the beginning of a classless society, in which deference had been brought to an end, then it needs to be seen as such with one important qualification. Deference is still demanded, but not to a class that imagines itself deserving of it by birth. It is now demanded by a bureaucracy, and one whose face is less appealing even than that of the old upper class. The last remnants of feudalism and of noblesse oblige have been swept away by the advent of welfarism. Individual duty has been replaced by the duty of the state. If there is a shortage of role models in society for people like Tom Riley, it will not purely be because his father may have been absent for 6 years of his childhood fighting for his country, or may have been killed in the war, or may have come home and then run off with another woman. It is because the traditional forces in society of setting an example and giving a lead have themselves been emasculated, their role supplanted by that of the state. A community, however feudal, no longer deals with the likes of Tom Riley before they go wrong. There are what we now call social workers, and the probation service, to do that instead. If you think back to Went the Day Well, which I discussed in the first of these talks, there is no longer, it seems, a class who, without any prompting by the state, knows it has a role to bring in everyone else along behind it. The only member of the upper classes we meet in the Blue Lamp exhibits the new decadence of her caste. She is stopped for careless driving and proceeds to patronise and insult the policeman who does so. It is not just the lower orders who no longer see the need to play by the rules, and for whom the traditional ties of one part of society to another appear to have been broken. Two violent acts seem to me to typify the beginning and the end of the political journey made by the British cinema in the 1940s. The self-sacrifice of the Lady of the Manor in Went the Day Well, running out of a room full of children with a hand grenade and blowing herself up, begins the journey to idealism. The shooting of George Dixon in the Blue Lamp aborts it. The destination, glimpsed occasionally in the distance before 1945, may no longer even exist. Whisky galore and passport to Pimlico register this with typical British phlegm. Yet The Blue Lamp, unlike those two other films, finds nothing to joke about. Poor old Mrs. Dixon is widowed, left to face an old age without either husband or son, who both, in their different ways, died in the line of duty. P.C. Mitchell, the last person we see in the film, has played a vital part in the capture of Dixon's murderer. But one senses from his demeanour that this is not the job he thought he was coming into. His dissolution must stand for all societies. It is not, perhaps, too early to wheel out the cliché that, having won the war, Britain was busily engaged in the business of losing the peace. This would be a slow and, for many, a painless defeat, with no instant harsh reality, such as the arrival of the Nazis on the doorstep. Therefore, the British film industry had nothing to lose by portraying the truth about post-war Britain in a way it could not or dared not have done during the war, when the script read that we were all in it together. The films it made were, for the most part, well-acted, well-written, and highly entertaining. They remain, in many cases, unsurpassed by what came afterwards, not least because the rise of television in the 1950s ensured that most homemade entertainment looked down at heel, cheap, and formulaic. But the films of the 40s were beyond entertainment. They had a distinct political message. Those who worked at Ealing claimed there was a left-wing ethos at the studios, like that of a country that had put Attlee into Downing Street in 1945. Yet the ethos did not stop filmmakers noting the contrast of reality and adapting to reflect the disillusion too. After all, business is business. Sadly, what the film industry could not see at the end of the 40s, or would not believe, was that over the next decade, it, too, would fall victim to a seismic change.
That was the final programme in Simon Heffer's series of essays on British cinema of the 1940s. The essays were first broadcast last September, and the producer was Beattie Rubens. It's 11 o'clock and in a couple of hours I'll be taking you through the night here on Radio 3 with a concert from last year's Chopin Festival in Warsaw. Schumann's Piano Concerto and Chopin's Second Piano Concerto played on pianos of their time. That's from 1 o'clock tonight. BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. And now, World on 3 with Mary Ann Kennedy.
Some beautiful things lined up for you tonight from around the globe. Discs from Brazil, Cambodia, Egypt, Armenia and more. And as ever, we'll have some fabulous live music here in the studio. I'm Mary Ann Kennedy and the World on Three guest tonight is a real pioneer from the Gambia, the first female kora player from a celebrated griot family. Lopa Katari will be finding out more about her later on. But let's hear straight off what makes Sona Jabarte so special.
So I'm here today with my full band, but I'm going to start off with a piece on the kora entitled Sunjata, which is a traditional piece from West Africa, which chronicles the history of the whole of the Manding Empire. And it's a very important piece in the repertoire, but also one of my favourites. Thank you.
Sona Jubarte playing in session for World on Three, one of a family of musicians, a cousin of the great kora player Tumani Jubarte, but showing there that she's a great performer in her own right. Now, the new Nordic movement has been something of a phenomenon over the past few years, the crossing of the waters between the music and musicians of Scandinavia and Britain and Ireland. And while this next trio don't strictly fit into the category, inasmuch as they're a trio of English lasses, the music does draw on traditions of Northern Europe as much as from home. Lady Masary are Hannah James, Sophie Askew and Rowan Rennigan. They got together in their common notion of creating a new female vocal group, and they took their name from one of the characters to be found in the Child Ballads. Their new album is called Weave and Spin, and you might already have heard a track featured on Late Junction last month, but no worries if not. Enjoy this one. It's their take on the traditional Irish I Know My Love.
I know my love by his way of walking, I know my love by his way of talking, I know my love in his suit of blue. And if my love leaves me, what will I do? And still she cried, I love him the best, and a troubled mind knows no rest. And still she cried, bonny boys of you, and if my love leaves me, what will I do? If my love knew I could wash and wring, and if my love knew I could weave and spin, I'd make a jacket of the finest kind, but for want of money he's left me behind. And still she cried, I love him the best, and a troubled mind knows no rest. And still she cried, bonny boys of you, and if my love leaves me, what will I do? Every night he takes a strange girl upon his knee. Now don't you think that it vexes me? And still she cried, I love him the best, and a troubled mind knows no rest. And still she cried, bonny boys of you, and if my love leaves me, what will I do?
Del bar.
That was the young flamenco singer Sandra Carrasco, who hails from Andalusia, guesting on the latest project from the Spanish singer and guitarist Javier Limón. It's a musical journey around the Mediterranean. Now, that's not necessarily a unique thing to do, but in each musician's journey, the reactions, experiences and resulting music surely are. What sets Javier's pilgrimage apart is that he's taken his journeyings and then used them to collaborate with female musicians from all around the Med, each acting as the voice of a particular place. They range from the very well-known, such as Portuguese fadista Marisa and Greek singer Eleftheria Arvanitaki, to relatively new voices that are introduced to us in this project, like Sandra Carrasco. Before that was another lead from the ladies, the English trio Lady Masary, and they count among their fans the Icelandic singer Bára Grimsdóttir that I played a few weeks ago on the show. They've also set about reviving the mouth music tradition of diddling, and it's inspired by music from Scandinavia, but in the knowledge that it was once a thriving tradition in England and still is in Scotland as well. You're listening to Marianne Kennedy here on World on Three, and it's another collaborative venture next. This is the brainchild of the leader of the Shetland supergroup Fiddler's Bid. Chris Stout has always had a great musical curiosity, working in a whole range of genres, jazz and electroacoustic music as much as the traditional music of his native Fair Isle. A few years ago now, he and a bunch of other Scots musicians had the chance of collaborating at Glasgow's Arches Arts Venue with a group of musicians from Sao Paulo in Brazil. A reciprocal visit was next, all done.